programs Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly, and it's your connection to local music and more. It's all music today, and on the show, for the first portion of it, we're going to have a conversation with Steve Larson, who is the music director and conductor of the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra, which plays a concert this Saturday night in Urbana called Faith, Tragedy, and Joy. Rather interesting program, which we will hear about. And in the second portion of the show, we'll hear some klezmer music. And if you're not sure what that is, we will be sure to tell you. The Maxwell Street Klezmer Band from Chicago is going to be performing at the Krannert Center in Urbana Sunday night at 7 o'clock, an evening of Jewish music. And their leader, Lori Lippitz, is my guest in the second portion of the show. It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. That was the Scherzo movement from the Second Symphony by Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky, the symphony nicknamed the Little Russian.
Incorrect these days.
Steve is talking, and I'm turning on. It should be so, Ukrainian, right?
Yeah. Little Russia was the name that the Russians called Ukraine at the time, and it was not only just a name for the area, but it was a slightly pejorative term. It's there, it's stuck. So, you know, it's our story and we're sticking to it. It's a Little Russian.
So if somebody were to record it today, would they change that name?
I don't think so. No, they still call it, because that's for better or for worse, it's what it was called. It's the name of the symphony.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be, it can be pejorative if you think of it that way.
If you choose to take offense.
There you go. And that's Steve Larson, who is the music director of the Champaign-Urbana Symphony. And that complete Second Symphony of Tchaikovsky is going to be on their concert this Saturday at 7:30 at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana. And this is part of their 50th anniversary season, which is quite a milestone for any organization, particularly any arts organization these days. And you have given the program the title of Faith, Tragedy, and Joy. Why?
Faith, referring to the opener of the program, Mendelssohn's overture to his oratorio, St. Paul, or Paulus in German. The overture is essentially a chorale prelude on the chorale Wachet auf, very much in the style of Bach, with a romantic orchestra. Tragedy refers to the one of the sub-themes of the flute concerto by Christopher Rouse. Rouse seems to have this way of, in the midst of writing a piece, he will encounter some great heart-wrenching tragedy that moves him very deeply, and then incorporates that into the substance of the work. And as is in this piece, the third movement, there are five movements of the flute concerto, all of which run without pause. But the third movement is inspired, if I can use that word, by a tragedy in England. The details are a little fuzzy right now, but an 8-year-old boy or something like that was killed by a couple of, rather gratuitously, by a couple of 14-year-olds or 12-year-old boys, just a senseless tragedy. And he was so moved by the by this tragedy that he wanted to incorporate some of the pathos, the grief he felt, into the third movement of the piece. And it's quite striking, the depth of feeling that emerges in the middle of this concerto. It's really very, very moving. The joy part is the Tchaikovsky Symphony, which is, I think you can certainly say, despite the seriousness of its first movement, is one of his most upbeat works. It's certainly not varnished with any of the sense of tragedy or fate that comes into the fourth, fifth, or sixth symphonies. One of the reasons I chose this is that Tchaikovsky is a composer that you hear people say, or at least infer, that Tchaikovsky wrote three symphonies, 4, 5, and 6. And everybody forgets about 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. And those three, 2nd is my personal favorite.
And I've always enjoyed the 1st, the Winter Dreams one.
Yes, I like that too. I think 2nd is a better piece. He's gotten his legs as a composer, certainly as an orchestrator. 3rd, I've yet to warm up to, the Polish Symphony. It just doesn't really do anything for me. But I've done the 1st 2 several times and like them very much.
And why did it get nicknamed the Little Russian or the Ukrainian, if we would do it now?
The use of a Ukrainian folk tune in the last movement called The Crane, which is used almost as a theme in the basis, a theme for a series of variations, forms the first theme of the last movement and is repeated many, many, many times, almost ad nauseum, but with a certain degree of effectiveness with the repetition in the last movement.
You left off a piece. You're doing a fanfare?
Yes, the fanfare, yes. This is a fanfare, part of our series. We've commissioned a fanfare for every one of our concerts, and this one is actually a very unusual piece. It's called Cahokia, and
just the sort of name I would give a fanfare.
Well, it's actually a kind of a tribute, a short tribute to the. You're familiar with the Cahokia Mounds in Illinois.
That's where I've heard the name. Okay, I wouldn't remember. That's where that came from.
An Indian civilization. It's a tribute to the people who lived there, formed a civilization, and faded away. It's a rather unusual piece.
Brian Baxter, the composer.
Yes, yes.
Where did you find? Did you? I assume you found him or knew
yes,
of him.
Yes, he was one of the applicants. We invited people to apply for the fanfare competition, and he was one of the four composers we chose.
And this is as part of the 50th anniversary celebration.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Let's hear a little bit of the flute concerto, which you talked rather eloquently about. You said that Christopher Rouse tends to find some tragic theme or some tragic event and work it in. Does that mean a lot of his music has that?
Several of his pieces do. I was kind of struck by a Symphony No. 2 also has a tragic element in it. And there's another piece, I can't think of the name now, that it seems to be a kind of a trait of his And it's not the informing element of the piece, but it's something that forms a very important part of it once it's finally finished.
The first movement and last have the same title, but it is not the usual Italian movement title.
No, it's a Gaelic word. Amran. And I probably should have remembered what that means now, but it's a very expressive lament in the Gaelic style. He tries to do in this piece is to pay tribute to his Gaelic ancestors. So there are various Gaelic elements in this. The first and last Amrans are one of them, but also there's a certain Celtic flavor to the second movement, and most especially to the scherzo, which ends in a wild reel for orchestra, with the flute and orchestra working them up into a frenzy and into an Irish reel before finally coming to just absolutely exploding and petering out in the little cadenza that leads into the last movement.
Maybe we'll try to sample a little of both here. I just looked up here in the notes to this particular recording, which is the Houston Symphony led by Christoph Eschenbach. Anran means is the Gaelic word for song.
There we go.
Simple enough. So here is the opening movement of the Flute Concerto of Christopher Rouse. It's here played by, where is the flutist credited?
Carol Winsence.
Carol Winsence.
I've done it with Carol Winsence. The connection is that a mutual friend of ours, Dick Nordloff, Dick and Jody Nordloff, commissioned the piece. So it was premiered in Houston, and it's been done several places since. I did it 2 years ago with Carol in Rockford. And for this performance, we're doing it with Jonathan Keebles, the flute professor at the University of Illinois.
So here's Carol Winsence, the Houston Symphony, Christoph Eschenbach, music by Christopher Rouse. from his Flute Concerto on Live and Local. That wild jig-like moment Steve Larsen described, and a couple of the other elements that make up just a portion of the Flute Concerto by American composer Christopher Rouse. That was a performance of those excerpts here by flutist Carol Winsence with the Houston Symphony led by Christoph Eschenbach. And the Champaign-Urbana Symphony is performing it Saturday night at the Krannert Center in Urbana with soloist Jonathan Keeble, who is a flute professor at the University of Illinois, and of course conducted by Steve Larsen, who's my guest on this portion of Live and Local. Coming up, we have Lori Lippitz, who is the director of the Maxwell Street Klezmer Band, who are going to be in Urbana on Sunday night. And our program today is made possible with support from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, now with a new dinner menu. Tapas served every evening until 2 a.m., along with lunch on Friday from 10:30 to 2:30, and brunch on Saturday and Sunday. Information on menus, wine, and beer lists is at RadioMariaRestaurant.com. That sounds like it would be a rather challenging work to put together.
It is. It is a very tough piece. I'm glad I've been through it once. I know the traps now. By the way, that second excerpt you played, you faded into, is a moment that we were talking before. It seems like a lot of contemporary composers, when they write a concerto, will try to include a moment of involving the soloist section, particularly if it's a wind, brass, or percussion player. And at that moment, he brings all three flutes in the orchestra in for a wild quartet, kind of a jam session with the soloist. It's really a lot of fun.
When you said that, and of course you said that to me as we were listening to the music, I was immediately thought of the second horn concerto of Strauss.
Yes.
Where he does that at the end of the last movement. I remember the ba-ba-ba-ba-beep-bom, ba-da-da-da, and then and I sort of judge a recording on how well the horn section does that, which is sort of dumb, but, you know, I guess as a long-ago horn player, I'd sort of think about that. But that's a lot of fun. Well, it's a really, really nice program, wonderful variety. I think you've had a lot of programs of late, recent years, that one could say that about, some music that people haven't heard and will be very glad they did. And, of course, this year doing these fanfares is a nice touch for each concert and the 50th anniversary.
Yeah, it's fun. That PDF file arrives in my email, and, oh, boy, let's see what this is. No idea what to expect.
But, of course, now, you had to judge these things, or not?
We judged. I judged the entrants on the basis of their previous works.
Ah. So whatever they got, you had to, whatever you got, you had to play.
Right.
Once you agreed with it.
Had no idea what was coming.
But
which really makes it more fun in a way.
And they're all short.
They're all 5 minutes was the stipulation. And so 5 minutes or less. And so we have two more coming after this. And
so if it turns out to be awful, at least you know it'll be over quickly.
That's right. That's one advantage we have as orchestra directors over, let's say, theater directors, in that, you know, you put on an evening of theater, and unless you're doing one X or something like that, you're stuck with the play for the evening. At least with an orchestra concert, you don't like something, in a few minutes it'll be over and you're on to something else.
Although with a one act, I suppose, you know, there's usually no intermission, and then you can't get out.
No, that's true.
Without, you know, either embarrassing yourself or the performers. Well, I don't think people will feel that way about this concert.
Oh,
certainly
no.
Not about the Mendelssohn overture that follows the fanfare. And here's just a fragment of that, since you talked about that earlier. Very conservative choral music, Mendelssohn. This is the overture to his Oratorio St. Paul.
Thank you.
And just in the interest of time, we have to fade out of that, but you get the idea. That's I thought it might be a nice little antidote to the wildness of the portion of the Christopher Rouse Concerto that we heard as well. That's just the beginning of the Overture to St. Paul by Mendelssohn, this performance, the Scottish National Orchestra, led by Leon Botstein on Live and Local. And you can hear the full overture, along with Rouse's Flute Concerto, Tchaikovsky's Second Symphony, and Brian Baxter's Fanfare Cahokia at the Krannert Center Saturday night at 7:30. It's the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra, Steve Larson conducting, and my guest on Live and Local here on FM 90.9. As always, Steve, it's a pleasure to have you in the studio.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Best of luck on the concert.
Thank you again.
We just heard a tune by the Maxwell Street Klezmer Band, based in Chicago, which in English comes across as Where You Was When the Money Was, in the Yiddish, Wo Bist Du Gewesen. And on Live and Local, right now, we have on the telephone Lori Lippitz, who is the band leader of Maxwell Street Klezmer Band. And I'm trying to remember if I've had the chance to hear you guys in Chicago. I don't actually think so.
Oh.
And, of course, you were going to be here, the plan was, back in the fall, and the Krannert Center in Urbana had a power outage, and nobody could see anything, so that was that.
That's true. We were there.
But nobody could tell.
That's true.
Well, they could have told if you played. So now you're going to be at the Krannert Center and trying this again, an evening of Jewish music, sponsored by Chabad here at the University of Illinois, this Sunday at, I think your concert starts at 6 maybe or 7?
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock.
Yes.
So tell us about a little bit of the history of the Maxwell Street Klezmer Band. I know it's got something to do with the old marketplace up there.
Sure, Kevin. Yeah, I named the band after Maxwell Street, the Maxwell Street Market, because, well, it's associated with Chicago and lots of the other bands at the time. Now we're talking about the early 1980s. When I started the group, the other bands at the time were pretty much focused on New York, Ellis Island, you know, that whole New York as the gateway to the Jewish experience. And of course, I've got all the civic pride. I wanted to talk about Midwestern Jewish traditions. So I named it after our Maxwell Street. Maxwell Street Market was started up in the late 1800s on Sunday mornings, because the Jewish Sabbath, of course, is from Friday night to Saturday night, so we couldn't open up a market during that time of the weekend. So first thing Sunday morning, all the push carts would be out lined up and people would be selling their wares, and it was apparently very festive and went on for a very long time. In fact, it's an incarnation of it is still around a few blocks away from where it used to be.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not on Maxwell Street anymore, is it?
No, that's University of Illinois parking lot, I believe. But yeah, nearby Maxwell Street.
And what possessed you to start a group like this?
Yes, that's a question I've often asked myself. What possessed me was that I was very excited when I first heard the music. I'd been raised with a lot of involvement with my Jewish community and with Jewish music. We're a very musical family, but I wasn't very excited about the music. It was Israeli music at that time was what we were mostly exposed to. The only things I knew about traditional music prior to Israel were, I would say, orchestrated or sort of soupy versions of these things that had come up through the 1960s, and that was not interesting. But as part of the folk music revival of the 70s, in particular the beginning of world music, some people started to play these old sides. They're not vinyl sides. They were shellac, 78 RPMs that turn up at garage sales and so on, and found these orchestras that had been recorded in the 1910s, 1920s, early 30s in New York, made up of immigrant musicians playing this amazing dance music that they used to play in the old country, but playing it with a kind of a immigrant flair, you know, a little Dixieland, a little big band, a little extra gliss on the trombones, maybe a tenor banjo. And I just fell in love with it. And I was a Russian major at the time at the University of Chicago, but I thought I'd take a little break, and that was in 1983.
And so your little break is still going on.
That's true.
25 years, well, 20, what
yeah.
is that, 20,
26,
26
yeah.
years ago now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I am trying to remember when I first heard this music, but I would say the same thing. I kind of fell in love with it, too, and I've always just described it when people ask, what is klezmer? I just say, well, think of kind of a Yiddish jazz. But you said Dixieland, which that strikes me as the closest sort of jazz comparison, just because with both of those types of music, it always sounds to me, particularly in the faster stuff, where something is going on while something else is going on, and it's just this marvelous cacophony sometimes, where it's people are improvising whatever they want to do
at
the same time,
within a certain frame, and
sure.
all ending up in the same place at the
yeah.
same time. That's really accurate. I think, Kevin, you're right on there, because later big band is very orchestrated, whereas early big band is a little more unplanned, and with the idea that here's the melody and you know how to improvise your part, you know, and then it all fits together like a big puzzle. And that is the way that the music was played, and in fact it was so unorchestrated originally that the conductor, who's usually the clarinetist, the band leader, would come up with a certain sound that he would make on the clarinet. It was kind of an upward, ascending scale, and then it would go up to that high note, and that's how everyone knew that no matter where they were, that's where the tune ended. And that would be because, of course, you know, the light would go on saying that the recording time had expired, and there was only 3-minute recording time on the 78 RPM. So whenever that was out, that was time to wrap the tune up.
You had to stop.
That's right.
You mentioned the clarinet as usually the band leader. Of course, in this case, you're the band leader and vocalist
uh-huh.
and guitarist.
Yes.
Is that simply because you founded it, and so you you could? Or?
Yes, I haven't been the prime vocalist lately. We have a lovely vocalist, Kimberly Nussbaum, and we have a lovely male vocalist, Pavel Reutman, who will be our vocalist coming up this Sunday. I started it because I was a singer, because that's what I did. I wasn't actually trained as a musician, but I've had the pleasure of sharing that out with people who are trained musicians and
Well, singers are musicians. You meant instrumentalist.
They're not instrumentalists, and they don't necessarily go to music school. The many fine singers do.
Yeah, sure.
You know, we have a junior klezmer band. There's a little slight digression. A junior klezmer band where we train young people in junior high school and high school to play klezmer music. And many of our graduates, we've been doing this since 1992. So, you know, every year more kids go off and take the music to other places as they, you know, go to college and onward. And we have a singer this year named Cheryl, who came to us at junior high school age. Actually, we picked her up at her bat mitzvah, and is now going on to a career in opera.
Mm.
So it's really fun to see that, you know, you can pass the music along, and young people can grab it and run with it, and that's really that was the whole purpose of starting the band, you know, be that missing link, because if you have one generation without it, then, you know, it's gone.
Right, exactly. We were talking about some similarities to Dixieland in particular, and you said, of course, at the outset that this style really came from Eastern Europe, immigrants. So it's always striking to me also when you hear, say, Greek traditional music or music from various parts of the Balkans. We have a Balkan music ensemble here. Mm-hmm. There's some striking similarities.
Yes, and Kevin, you're so accurate. You might not know, but one of the first klezmer clarinetists, whose name was Dave Terrace, one of the first, I should say, to record, alongside another clarinetist named Naftalia Brandwein, Terrace recorded on Columbia, the green label, the so-called race label, in Yiddish letters and with Yiddish titles for klezmer, for the Jewish audience. And then he would also record on the same label with Greek letters, with a slightly changed name for Greek audiences at that time. So there's a whole lot of similarity in the clarinet's leadership role and the fact that it tends to be very fast and sort of complicated and challenging, which makes it, of course, very interesting.
Well, having said that, we have a tune here that is not so fast or complicated that we thought we'd stick in the middle here. You sent me a few files that we've sampled one of them, and we've got a couple more. Lea Sarabande.
Yes. Well, let me segue into the violin.
Sure.
The Fiddler on the Roof, of course, is the best known klezmer musician probably in the United States, and that's because the violin is emblematic. It's the symbol of the Jew in Eastern Europe, of that era, the time of the shtetl, that whole culture that, you know, really is no more. And the violin speaks with a voice that is very evocative and, as of course, in many cultures, fiddle is very important. But in particular, in the klezmer music, I would say it becomes a focal point. And Alex, who is our violinist, came to this country in 1989. He was told at that time, you never make it as a musician, you know, and he started studying computer programming. But fortunately, someone brought us together, and I encouraged him, and he eventually decided to leave the programming career, for better or worse, and go and become a klezmer violinist. So the piece that you're going to hear here is something that he composed for my wedding back about 14 years ago, I think. It's a piece in the style of the old world klezmer fiddle, and it's his own, let's say, channeling of that into his own creation.
And his name is Andy?
His name is Alex Kaufman.
Alex Kaufman.
And this is his piece called Lea's Sarabande.
With the Maxwell Street Klezmer Band from Chicago, who are going to be here at the University of Illinois coming up on Sunday evening. And you're hearing it on Live and Local on FM 90.9. That was a tune called Lea's Sarabande by the violinist in that performance, Alex Kaufman, with the Maxwell Street Klezmer Band, who are going to be at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana this coming Sunday evening at 7 o'clock, a program entitled An Evening of Jewish Music, sponsored by the Chabad Center at the University of Illinois. And we have with us on Live and Local during this portion of the program the band leader of the Maxwell Street Troupe, Lori Lippitz, talking with us from, are you in Chicago or are you in Evanston?
I'm in Skokie.
You're in Skokie.
The other Jewish homeland, yes.
Yeah, the other Jewish home, yeah, that's right. Many synagogues as you drive on Dempster Street.
Yes.
I think, if I remember right.
Yes, but not enough delis, only like two delis.
Really?
Yeah.
It seemed like there was a deli every other block when I read.
Hard times, you know.
Oh, there are many of them gone, huh? That's too bad.
Yes.
That's too bad. Well, we were talking a little bit about instrumentation of a klezmer band, so I really have two questions. First, what does the term klezmer come from?
Great question, Kevin. It's originally a Hebrew word, or two words, klezmer, which means vessel of song. It's an ancient phrase that used to denote musical instruments, which used to be sometimes made out of vessels and so on. And then it became a term, a klezmer became a klezmer, which means a musician. And eventually it came to mean a musician who specializes in playing at Jewish weddings. They played at other people's weddings, too. They went all over like gypsies and played for everyone. But one who specialized in this dance repertoire rather than a conservatory musician.
Although there is a klezmer conservatory band, now that I think of it. I think I have a record or two of theirs.
Mm-hmm.
What is the typical instrumentation besides clarinet and violin and vocalist of a klezmer group, and then how does yours fit into the tradition, your instrumentation?
That's a good question, because they really are quite different. In fact, if you go to the klezmer bands, revival bands that are around today, you'll find all kinds of different instrumentation. Ours is the instrumentation of an early jazz band, so plus early jazz band, including what you'd find in a pop orchestra, meaning also including a violin. So clarinet, violin, trumpet, trombone, saxophone, keyboard, bass, drums, and a vocalist, or usually a male and a female vocalist. So we were basing it on that 1910s, 1920s, and 30s early jazz American sound. Some of the klezmer bands are based on the original sound, which would be, let's say, if you were in Russia, might be accordion, clarinet, percussion, vocals, and tambourine, something like that, or a drum kit. If you were and maybe violin. If you were in Romania, Hungary, that part of the world, it might be more string-oriented, a bass. A cymbalon, which is a hammer dulcimer, and two fiddles, and maybe a clarinet, maybe not, and so on. It really differs. Oh, I forgot, of course, if you're in New York, it might have a rock guitar in it, you know.
But yours doesn't. Yours is more like the big band sound.
Right.
Early big band sound.
We are acoustic, and we're trying, even when we don't generally play a lot of klezmer covers, per se. In other words, things that are exactly the way that they were in the original recordings. We tend to do things with them. Alex is the main arranger, and he works with those originals and comes up with something, something new out of that. But we're trying to keep intact the soul of the music, which is, say, an old soul. It's not a contemporary revision or what do you call it, evolution into a rock genre, for example, or hip hop or something. We want it to be recognizable as otherworldly, from a previous culture.
And most of it is the right way to say it is dance music, or a lot of it.
Instrumental music is dance music. That's correct. It's not. Sort of sit back and listening music. So if people are coming on Sunday night and they want to, squeeze around the aisles, there's not a great dance floor at the Cranard. I got to say, that's something they have to work on.
In the lobby, you can do it.
That's about it. But if people want to dance to it, it is dance music. The vocals tend to come from different sources. Pavel Reutman is a Russian tenor whose voice is identical with the vocal quality and tenor of 1920s, 1930s Yiddish pop vocalists. It's kind of uncanny. And he comes from Russia. He's a cantor here now in Skokie, actually. But his what he does and his vocal renditions are from the Yiddish theater, primarily, which was booming at the time that people still spoke Yiddish in New York and in other parts of the country. They would tour all over the country. They'd come to Chicago and play here, and all over the place. So that's the vocal repertoire tends to be more of that very often comic, sometimes sentimental, and sometimes folk music repertoire.
And so he's going to be your vocalist on Sunday's performance.
That's correct.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a blast. I always think klezmer music is a blast. And I hope that we'll help to get you a good audience. And I know that Chabad intends this to be an outreach to not only the Jewish community, but the entire community that likes music.
That's really important to say. Actually, ironically, most of our public performances, as opposed to weddings and bar mitzvahs, most of our public performances would be to almost primarily non-Jewish crowd. Mm. And especially when we go to Europe, which we've done with some frequency, we go often to Germany especially, well, that's not a Jewish crowd. The music, however, is extremely accessible. And, if a person enjoys something that is emotional, that is driving, that has a lot of energy, but also a certain amount of refinement. It's not rough music. The skill set has to be very high. And they're going to enjoy the music. They don't have to understand the Yiddish, and in fact, most of the Jewish audiences don't.
And you told me, actually, before we started talking for the microphone, that Yiddish wasn't in your background either.
That's true. Well, not too many people in my generation speak Yiddish, not at least around here. But I was so taken with the music when I heard it, and I heard it on the radio, that I thought, well, we did that in Chicago. It really became a mission of mine to say, well, this could add a lot to my community. This could add a lot to the depth and the emotional variety of my life and the people around me. And this also deserves a place, at the table with all the other kinds of world music out there. So I just thought, well, let's do that,
And you're still doing it.
I'm still doing it.
And since you kindly said that radio is a great place to hear klezmer music, let's wrap up and we'll go out with one more tune. My guest on Live and Local has been, for this portion, Lori Lippitz, leader of the Maxwell Street Klezmer Band, which is coming to the Krannert Center in Urbana this coming Sunday night. The concert starts at 7 o'clock, and you're all invited. And thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks. Could I say one thing about the song you're going to hear?
I would like you to. That was going to be my last question, so there you go.
Vubista Gavain that we started with was a song about hard times, which I thought would be very nice and appropriate for our recessionary times. This one, Lebedige Hanga, just means a lively hanga. A hanga is a kind of one of the many types of circle dances that was popular in Eastern Europe when they would kick up their heels and dance all night. So I hope you do.
And feel free to do it at your end of the radio. Thanks again, and enjoy the Maxwell Street Klezmer Band here on Live and Local on FM 90.9.